Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Just over 60 years ago, in September of 1957, Terrence Roberts and eight other young people became the first African-American students at Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. The integration of the school did not go smoothly.
This is Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now. And their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
These nine students are known as the Little Rock Nine, and all nine of them received the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian honor in the United States, in 1999. After high school, Terrence Roberts went on to get a PhD in psychology. He had a distinguished career as a professor. He is now CEO of Terrence J. Roberts & Associates, a management consultant firm devoted to fair and equitable practices. He's the author of many books, and he'll be speaking at Coe College in Cedar Rapids on Friday, April 6th at 7 p.m., and he is here with me now. Terrence Roberts, what an honor to talk to you.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to be on the show.
I know this is a story you've told many times, but let's go back in time to the 1950s, before the events that we know about at Central High School. Can you tell me what life was like for you in Little Rock in the 1950s?
Yes. In fact, it was a big shock to me to find out what was really going on when I joined this drama we call life. We were, as a nation, operating under the aegis of the Plessy v. Ferguson decision. Supreme Court had decreed in 1896 that separate but equal would be the law of the land, and that pertained to racial group membership. We were divided up into racial groups and were put in this hierarchy, with one group on top and other groups following. It was very surreal. I couldn't understand it because I had come into the world with some DNA component that demanded rational explanation, but there was none. No one seemed to be able to answer my questions with any clarity. It was only much later, as a student, that I began to dig out the information for myself, and it was very scary, for one thing, to find out what the situation was. So life for me was very circumscribed. I had no rights to speak of. I was not a favored individual. I was persona non grata in most places, most public institutions, because even though we were very, very separate, we were nowhere near equal, ever.
What was the school that you attended in grade school and junior high school? What was your school like?
Well, you know, as fantastic as it may sound, we had wonderful schools. In the midst of all of that horrible segregation, the all-black schools had teachers who were exceptional. They were well-trained. Many of them had degrees beyond the baccalaureate, but they couldn't get jobs anyplace. No one would hire them. They were unable to start businesses in many cases. But they could teach. Teaching jobs at the all-black schools were open. So as a consequence, we had choice. We had the opportunity to choose the best. And it proved to be exactly what we needed. Because rather than allow anger to consume them, this group of people massed together, they had some sort of tacit agreement that they would propel us toward excellence. So our curriculum went far beyond what was mandated. We learned the basic curriculum, yes, but we also delved into politics and philosophy and history. We did a lot of extracurricular kind of learning that I wouldn't have gotten elsewhere.
As you became aware of segregation, you talked about seeking out answers on your own and trying to understand why the society that you were born into was structured in this way. Was your family politically aware? Was that something that was supported in your household, those kind of questions?
Oh, yes. My parents were willing to tell us as much as they knew. And they did know some things, but no, they didn't know a lot. And because they, too, had been in that situation for so long, there was a degree of having been acclimated to it. So their questions, if they ever had them, were no longer the kind of insistent questions that I had. But they were tolerant. In fact, when I came home and explained to them that I had volunteered to be one of this group that we know as Little Rock Nine, they didn't at all hesitate to support that decision. So in that sense, yes, they were political and politically aware. I think they sensed there was a window of opportunity here, a window that probably wouldn't be open very long, and if we didn't take advantage of it at that point, it probably would not happen ever again.
Well, you mentioned volunteering. Tell us that story, when you were given the opportunity to volunteer to desegregate Little Rock schools.
Well, the Little Rock School Board, and I think it was a function of the group of people who happened to be on the board at that time, decided that they should put together a program that would be in compliance with the Brown decision, which had been rendered in 1954. The Brown decision countermanded the Plessy decision. In fact, it was a 180-degree shift because Plessy said it's constitutional to discriminate. Brown said, no, it is no longer constitutional to discriminate. That in itself is a very interesting question to ponder. Which of the two is really constitutional? At any rate, the school board put together a plan, and after some false starts, they decided on grades 10, 11, and 12. Then representatives were dispatched to the two schools that were there for black kids, one middle school, one high school. And the question was posed, how many of you would like to be involved? Well, we had about 150 or more hands go up that morning. But then we had to go through the process of telling our parents about it, and then that led to a dwindling of the numbers very, very quickly, because the overall thinking was that these kids are going to be killed. This is not going to happen, and their blood will flow in the streets of Little Rock. And many parents simply said, no way, I am not going to do that.
Well, that was a very real possibility, as, of course, you learned. How did your parents react?
Well, like I said, they didn't hesitate to support me. They said, we will support you 100%. Now, how they arrived at that decision, I simply do not know. Because as a parent myself, from that perspective, I don't know if I could have been that eager and enthusiastic. But they were. And I think that's quite true of the parents of the other eight kids as well.
The first day that you tried to go to Central High School in Little Rock, you did not get into the school. Tell me what happened that day.
Well, that was the day that the governor had called out the National Guard. The night before, he had made a televised appearance, and he said, the Guard is there to keep the peace. He gave no intimation that they were really there to keep us out, but we quickly learned that once we arrived. And the Guard basically didn't say a word to us. They simply maintained their stance and posture, which wouldn't allow us to pass. So we had to go home. And then it was over 3 weeks before we made another attempt to enter the school. And during that 3 weeks, there was a lot of wrangling in and out of court, a lot of appearances by the governor on television. I think, in fact, there were some meetings between Eisenhower and the governor at the same time.
Well, and we have some audio from an address, a television address that was given by President Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1957. Let's listen to this.
Under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. If the use of local police powers had been sufficient, our traditional method of leaving the problem in those hands would have been pursued. But when large gatherings of obstructionists made it impossible for the decrees of the court to be carried out, both the law and the national interest demanded that the president take action. And so, with deep confidence, I call upon the citizens of the state of Arkansas to assist in bringing to an immediate end all interference with the law and its process. If resistance to the federal court order ceases at once, the further presence of federal troops will be unnecessary, and the city of Little Rock will return to its normal habits of peace and order. and a blot upon the fair name and high honor of our nation in the world will be removed.
Again, that was President Eisenhower addressing the situation at Central High School in Little Rock. Of course, even after the president's address, things didn't go smoothly. What do you remember about your first day of school at Central High, the first time that you actually were allowed to attend class?
Well, it's interesting to note, before I answer the question, it's interesting to note that Eisenhower implied that this was some sort of an aberration, and he urged the people of Little Rock to return to their normal habits of peace and order. That's somewhat comical. But aside from that, we got into school, and that's when the real trouble began, because the assembled students, many of them, administrators and teachers included, were not happy to see us. In fact, there were many people there who hated us with vile passion, and they let their feelings be known in word and in deed. So we suffered a lot from day one through the end of our school year. And it wasn't the easiest of tasks at all, to put it mildly. In fact, how we survived is something that I think about now and wonder, how on earth did that happen? You know, objectively looking at that situation, you would have assumed that all of us would have been killed because the attacks were that severe and that intense every day.
When you were in school, you were all separated as well. It's not like you could have classes with any of the other African-American students. You were each in a separate classroom all day, right?
Yes, because the way the school was set up, we were assigned homerooms based on our class status, whether we were 10th, 11th, or 12th grade. And then within each of those three divisions, you were assigned to rooms alphabetically. And none of our names were very similar, so we wound up being the Little Rock One 9 times.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking to Terrence Roberts. He was one of the Little Rock 9, one of the first 9 African-American students to integrate Central High School in Little Rock in 1957. He's going to be speaking at Coe College in Cedar Rapids on Friday, April 6th at 7 p.m. It's an address that is open to the public, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Terrence Roberts. He's one of the Little Rock 9, one of the first 9 African-American students to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. He's a recipient of the Congressional Gold Medal. That's the highest civilian honor in the United States. He went on after his high school career to get a PhD in psychology and had a distinguished career as a professor. And he is now CEO of Terrence J. Roberts and Associates, a management consultant firm, and also the author of many books. He'll be speaking at Coe College in Cedar Rapids on Friday, April 6th at 7 p.m. And just before the break, we were talking about what it was like when you actually got into the school. For that year at Central High School, you were isolated. You were the only African-American student in your classes. And the abuse that you suffered all day, every day, was emotional. It was also physical, right?
Yes. And it was complicated by the fact that our guards were not permitted to be in the rooms where we were. They escorted us through the hallways, but they couldn't enter the classrooms or the cafeteria or the gym or the auditorium or the library or the chapel, any of those places, not even the bathrooms. So we caught hell all the time, even though we had these armed guards escorting us.
Tell me about one of the ugly, terrible things that happened to you that year. Can you give me an example of just one of those many experiences?
Yes. We had a gym class. I had a gym class. I was the only black kid in there. And these kids were vicious because, you know, given the chaos in any kind of gym setting, they could throw balls or other gym equipment in my direction and then make the excuse that I should have known that the ball was being passed to me and that sort of thing. And then one day I got hit with a combination lock. Someone had taken a combination lock from the gym locker and threw it and caught me on the side of the head. It almost knocked me out. But that was one of the days when my vigilance level was limited for some reason. And ordinarily, I would have perceived it coming and got out of the way, but, you know, there were times when that just wasn't possible. I survived that, but just barely.
Did you have to seek medical treatment?
Yes, yes. The coach was in his office, so I went in there, and he was able to help me get some first aid. And I had another dilemma as a consequence of that, because as I went to change clothes, I found out that everything in my locker was soaked. Someone had poured water in there while we were having class. So now, here I am, injured and sort of woozy, nothing to wear. And I had to then make a phone call home to my mom, which I didn't want to do, because I knew she hovered over the phone, because the phone rang incessantly, and she would answer every time. And I used to tell her, Mom, you don't have to answer all those calls. You know probably who's on the line. But she said, no, I have to. And she finally told me why. She said, I don't want to miss the call that tells me you're no longer among the living. And that was a very chilling impact, because I hadn't known that that was a psychological issue she had to deal with every hour, every day.
Every day she waited to hear that. Were there moments of kindness?
At Central? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, not every single white person in Little Rock wanted to kill me. But the problem was, especially at school, word was out among the students, if you befriend the black kids, we will kill you too. So there was a great deal of reluctance for kids to step forward, although there were a few who did anyway. And they did suffer because they got beaten up as well. But I think it's important to note that whenever there is a group of people, you can count on the fact that there will most likely be some people whose thinking is very unique and different from the majority.
How about teachers? How were you treated by the teachers?
Same rule applies. They weren't all, you know, my enemy. But the majority of them were, honestly. Some hated us with such vile passion. And then others were much milder, but certainly not welcoming. And then at the other extreme of that continuum, there were teachers there who felt indignant that we were being treated horribly. But their voices were mute most of the time because they, too, felt social pressure. They had to live with these other folk, and it wasn't a good situation for them. But there were times, my algebra teacher, for instance, told the entire class there would be no kind of violence directed toward me in our class. And that was always a safe haven. I didn't get that protection in most of my other classes.
You went from this school, the all-black school that you described as a wonderful school. Clearly, you were a gifted student. You went into this incredibly toxic environment at Central High School. What did that do to your education?
Well, really not much, because I had declared myself to be an executive in charge of my own learning as early as first grade, because the first grade teacher had put this thought out. She told all of us kids, she said, you kids must become executives in charge of your own learning. You've got to take on CEO responsibility. Now, that made so much sense to me. So I figured no matter what the noise may be in the environment, I needed to focus on learning. So I was well prepared for Central in that respect. So even though there were all of these attempts to dissuade us from being there, we were able to focus. I think simply because we had developed a habit of learning very early in life. And once that's set, there's not too much that can throw you off.
Now, the story of your year at Central High School is one that has been told on many anniversaries. It's one that a lot of us are at least a little bit familiar with. What happened the next year may surprise some people. That's referred to as the lost year in Little Rock. What happened?
Well, the governor, who didn't really want desegregation at all, had a dilemma. He didn't quite know what to do for a long time, but sometime during the summer between the school year 57-58 and 58-59, he decided to close all high schools in Little Rock, not just Central. He closed all the high schools. Now, his thought was, if he did that, that would effectively thwart any attempts to desegregate. What the governor failed to realize, of course, was that when you close the schools down, of course, you have no kids learning whatsoever. That bit escaped him somehow, even though he was the chief executive. But, you know, he wrote an executive order, and it was done. So for that 1 year, all the schools were closed, and for many kids, it was indeed a lost year because they had no alternative. You know, poor kids who had no money couldn't afford private schools, and if they had no connections outside Little Rock, then they were simply left to their own devices for that year. It's turned into a very tragic overall outcome because many of them dropped out and never got back.
What did you do?
I took up an invitation from relatives who lived in Los Angeles, California, and finished high school in California. And by the way, I persuaded my entire family to move. So by December of 1958, we had given up residence in Little Rock and were now living in Los Angeles.
What was it like when you moved to Los Angeles? How was the school experience different there?
Well, in many ways, it was not that different. When you think about this country, there's not that much difference from region to region. In fact, I sometimes tell people that it's important to realize that the true South is any place south of Canada, so that there's no confusion about where you are. And also because I knew from discussions with my relatives that L.A. was not the nirvana that many people had assumed. This was no land of milk and honey when it came to being black in this country. So I had to learn the rules of racism as they were applied in L.A. And I did. You know, I'm a very quick learner, so I figured out how to navigate that terrain, much like I had learned how to navigate Little Rock.
You, as I mentioned, went on to get your PhD in psychology. Once you were able to pursue higher education, how did that change? I mean, what was the environment like as a college student for you?
Well, as it turns out, people who choose to go to college are usually people who have much more to think about than exploring the ideology of racism. And so I didn't experience a whole lot going to school because most of us were just busy learning, spending our time in libraries, soaking up knowledge. Now, this doesn't mean that some institutions were, you know, more or less in favor of maintaining the racist ideology, but it wasn't as apparent.
What drove you in thinking about getting a PhD? What drove you to continue your education to that point?
Well, for me, and it continues, I think every day my main task is to learn, because one of the first things I learned early in life was how little anyone knows. Most of us carry around this vast storehouse of ignorance. Too many of us are satisfied with that condition. I've never been. I take it to be my essential task in life to learn. And it's fascinating what happens, too, when you start on that course, because you begin to understand what the possibilities are. You begin to understand what options are available. And it's just a freedom to explore on my part.
I'm sure that in Little Rock, Arkansas, you were extremely well-known. Everyone knew who you were. When you went to California and you went to college, were there people that recognized you that knew what you'd gone through?
Not right away. In fact, I came to high school under the radar for several weeks, which was good because it took that long for local news media to catch up with me. And by the time the story appeared in the paper, I'd already established connections with other kids. So it was just sort of a blip on the screen at that point, nothing really big. Because by that time, I was involved in a lot of student activities. You know, and for me, that stands out because at Central, none of the nine of us were allowed to participate in any of the extracurricular activities. So when I got to L.A. High, I joined everything. So I was a rather busy beaver, and I made a lot of friends as a consequence.
What was your favorite extracurricular that senior year?
I think running. I ran cross-country, so that stood out for me.
When did people start turning to you and asking you to share this story? Because it's become such an important defining factor in your life, and it's given you the opportunity, obviously, to talk to many, many audiences over the years. When did that start? When did people start saying, hey, we want to hear what happened to you?
Actually, almost right away. When I moved to L.A., even while I was still in high school, I began, not on the scale I'm doing now, but, you know, I would talk to groups of people, school kids, churches, civic organizations.
Your experience and the fact that you've been asked to speak about it so often has given you a unique vantage point to really think about race in America, to think about policy in the United States. And one of the things that I've heard you say over the years is that we really need to look at the full history of the United States. Maybe the law changed in 1954, but we need to look at the 335 years before that to really understand the social structure in this nation. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you're right, and that's one of the main things I try to communicate to young groups, especially, because many times kids are born and they assume that life begins at that point. What they don't realize is that they're stepping into a drama that's been underway for many, many centuries. Knowing the history gives us enough information to identify what's going on in the present, and it puts us in a better position to analyze and assess what's really going on around us once we are part of this life. I think, in fact, too many kids don't understand the need to study anything, for that matter, but especially history. But if I can convince them of the efficacy of doing that, perhaps then we could create a generation of kids who become more astute, more politically aware, more engaged in civic responsibilities, and perhaps we could make some real changes. Right now, if we continue the same way we're going, it's just going to be a repeat of what we've seen for centuries. And that is not good. I mean, our history is replete with instances when things could have changed. But because of the insistence on those who were in power at the time, all attempts to change were thwarted. This happened especially during Reconstruction. But then, you know, we had Andrew Johnson as president, and he wanted none of it. So I think once kids understand and know what we're dealing with, perhaps that would be enough of an impetus to move them forward. I certainly hope so.
Well, I mentioned that it's been 60 years since 1957, or a little bit over 60 years since 1957, which to a child and to a lot of us, that sounds like a long time ago. But when you really think about it, it is recent history in the United States. There are many people who are still alive. There are many people who are policymakers who are still in power who were alive then, were part of the social structure of those times. I mean, this is not ancient history.
That's right. That's right. And I think that point is so important to make, so that people know and understand. And another thing that you learn as you take a look back is that you cannot isolate racism and place it in the context of human relationships, i.e. one person doing something or saying something to another. That's not the real focus. The real focus is looking at the underpinnings, the foundational practices, the philosophies, the systems, the institutions that continue to support this racist agenda. And that is so prevalent, but missed by so many because they simply don't know what they're looking for.
Well, it is invisible to a lot of people. Why do you think it's invisible? Why is it so hard to see?
Well, it's not that hard to see. I think it's all willful. It's all willful. I heard something the other day that really shocked me. It was from an educator who was in a school system who said they've come up with some new terminology to identify certain kids in their system, and they call it intentional non-learning. And I thought when I heard that, that is the very best ID for most people, intentional non-learners. And if you are intentionally maintaining a level of ignorance, that's not about things being invisible. That simply means I don't want to see, I don't want to hear.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. With me is Terrence Roberts. He is one of the Little Rock Nine, one of the first nine African-American students to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. After high school, he went on to get his PhD in psychology and has had a distinguished career. He's the author of many books, and he speaks to many audiences around the world. He'll be speaking at Coe College in Cedar Rapids on Friday, April 6th at 7 p.m. after a long day spent talking to many students as well. That speech at Coe College is open to the public. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is Terrence Roberts. He is one of the Little Rock Nine, one of the first nine African-American students to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. He is a recipient of the Congressional Gold Medal. That's the highest civilian honor in the United States. He received that from President Bill Clinton in 1999, and he received a PhD in psychology. He's had a distinguished career as a professor. He has authored many books. He'll be speaking at Coe College in Cedar Rapids on Friday, April 6th at 7 p.m. And before the break, we were talking about, you were saying that the deep-seated racism in our culture, this systemic racism, is something that a lot of people don't see. But let's talk a little bit more about that. I mean, you were talking about people willfully not seeing it. I think, you know, I live here in Iowa, and I grew up in Iowa. When I was a child, it's more diverse now, but when I was a child, it was not diverse. There are still many communities here that are not diverse. I would say I didn't see systemic racism, not because I didn't want to, but just because it wasn't part of my reality. I can see it now, but I did grow up in ignorance of that, and not because people were teaching me to be biased, just because no one was showing me this kind of systemic racism. I mean, that's a huge problem, because if a child isn't taught about it, they may not see it.
Tis true. And that's why it's so necessary, as I was saying much earlier, to become the executive in charge of your own learning, so that even though you may grow up with a cadre of people who don't share what they know, and in fact, they do know, they just don't tell you. But I think if pressed, and if they were honest, they would tell you, well, yeah, I knew that. So it's sort of like my neighbor. I have a neighbor across the street who didn't know for a time anything about my history, but once he found out, he said, well, you know, I used to see that stuff coming on television, but I would always change the channel because I didn't want my kids to see all of that ugliness. Hmm. And I thought to myself, wow, so this man was content to raise a bunch of airheads. Now, what that means is, because his kids grow up and become well-educated, and then they occupy positions of authority and power in the system, they take that same mindset with them. And that mindset being that this is a country of freedom and liberty for all. There are no bad things happening. And if people say they are, those are isolated events that don't really measure up to the main themes. And they continue to go blithely along as if life is all very good. That's unfortunate. But I realize that's the reality. And that's what we have to preach about, in a sense, to let people know that you have to question this so-called progress narrative that so many people are invested in today. Because to focus on progress means that you don't focus on the things that have never been addressed.
And that's something we love to do. We love to talk about progress. And a lot of people would say, well, we've come a long way since 1957. Do you think we have?
We have, no question about it. But we have to consider the direction we're going in. Are we going in the right direction? That would be my question. Yeah, we're making progress. We are massing things, you know, we're accumulating knowledge and wealth and so forth. But we're doing it at great expense because we haven't yet figured out how to create a society where every single person feels honored and embraced and loved and accepted. We're missing that part while we zip along on these superhighways.
With the presidential election of 2016, we've heard a lot of racial rhetoric. We've seen racial clashes. We've seen and heard from many more white supremacists than we were before that election. Now, obviously, these people were part of our culture before, but not as emboldened.
Noisy. They've been just as noisy, but unless you're paying attention to them, you don't see it. I contribute to the Southern Poverty Law Center, and so I get their publications, and I have been constantly reading about the activities that go on in this country. Because Morris Dees and his group have been stalwart warriors on the forefront in making sure that we have an opportunity to know if we choose, we can find out. So, yeah, they've been here. I mean, this, when you go back to 1619 as a starting point, and you see the intense efforts made to create this, what I call the national narrative, one where all the bad stuff is swept to the side. A lot of energy went into doing that with the collusion of people in the academy, with people in the legal system, with people in medicine and science. It's a real conglomeration, almost overwhelming when you start reading about it. But do you think a society who goes to that length to create this sort of linguistic fiction could use that energy to tell the truth? We'd have a different result, different outcome. So the big question is, why haven't we done that? I don't know the answer to that question, by the way.
In the 1970s and 1980s, there was a great deal of work done in desegregating the schools in this country. In recent decades, we've actually seen segregation going the other way. We are seeing more segregated schools today. What's your response to that?
Well, there was never any real desire to accomplish desegregation. I mean, I can't find any sort of marker in time or space that suggested we were really serious about this. No, you know, as I see it, the status quo is important. And sometimes the status quo will bend to give the impression that we're changing, but we'll snap back in an instant when the timing is right. And this is exactly what's happened around school desegregation. Integration has never been a preferred goal for people in this country. That's the simple truth. Now, given that, and the need to protect that, desegregation is merely a temporary ploy to take the heat off. Once the heat's off, we can stop fooling around with that one now. Let's get on with business as usual. Historically throughout, you'll see that push and bend and then go back. It's like an elastic band. Nothing about that makes any sense, however.
You strike me as a very optimistic man. I mean, we've been talking about a lot of ways in which we have not made progress since 1957. But you strike me as someone who has a lot of hope for the future. What gives you hope?
Well, simply because I can see the possibilities. I can see it in the eyes of young kids who, once they begin to figure out what the truth is, they're excited and they want to do something. And I encourage them to prepare themselves to learn as much as they can, to learn how to make decisions that are healthy, to learn how to model behavior that they'd like to see in others. This gives me hope. I mean, it's an indirect approach, but for me, it makes the most sense. Because if nothing else, kids will have that feeling inside that they've done the best they could do and life has more meaning. See, I hate to think that people would grow up in this country and think that the only meaning they could have is to acquire a lot of money, have a large house, several cars, and count that as a life. That simply is so empty. But if there's something burning inside that speaks to the desire to live in a community where all people are honored, that makes more sense to me. Because in the end, that makes the difference.
Young people catch a lot of flack in this country. We love to criticize whatever generation is coming up for not working hard enough or being too engrossed in technology is one of the things that we talk a lot about when we talk about young people today. But we also know that young people today are far more tolerant than the generations that came before them. And just recently, we've seen a lot of young people become very politically active and take their message to the streets and to social media and to Washington, D.C. What do you think about this generation that's coming up right now?
Well, I think that's quite true. And that's something I've seen, again, throughout my own lifetime. Generally speaking, as people reach adulthood, many of them simply make compromises, or they tell themselves that I am making the best choices possible for me. And that last part, for me, is the one thing that gets me, because it's so selfish. It's so tied to one's own needs. And I know it's almost impossible for people to look outside themselves and think about the needs of others, but eventually that's where we have to go. And I think these young people today are looking beyond themselves. They're taking the long view. Something I read some years ago was really important to me and made me feel really good. It's about the older homes and castles in England. The former generations planted trees because they knew these buildings would need to be restored and they need the same kind of lumber. So they planned hundreds of years in advance for that. And I thought, now there's an idea. If we could extrapolate from that and help young people realize that they're planning not perhaps for their own future, but for the future of their grandkids even, then that long-range planning would help them, because they would see beyond the current dilemmas and not be dissuaded by these forces of opposition that are current, because the goal would outweigh whatever problem the opposition presented at the moment.
It wasn't very long ago in this country, of course, that we elected our first Black president. And that was an incredible moment for so many people, no matter what kind of background they came from. Then there were people saying that, you know, we've become a post-racial society, which pretty quickly we figured out was not true. Do you feel like when Barack Obama was elected president, did that in some way blind people to the systemic racism in our culture in the United States? Did that give us...
No, I think they were already blind to it. But what they failed to realize was that it's never about race, because there really is no such thing as race. But the myth of race has taken its part and seems to reside in the minds of most people as truth. For many people, race is truth. And that's a sort of a weird dilemma. But yes, I know a lot of people saw this as some telling point where we had now reached racial nirvana. But in truth, we had not. From my estimate, the reason Barack Obama was elected president, because I think there were so many people who could not stomach the thought of a McCain-Palin ticket, given McCain's health and Palin's probable rising to the top. That just made absolutely no sense whatsoever. So they were willing to say, okay, he's not our first choice, but these folk over here, we're not even going there. And so, and then they threw him up against, Romney Ryan, very similar to McCain Palin when you think about it. But at some point, we quickly got to the next election and decided, okay, enough is enough. We might as well just say it like it is. And then we put this guy we have now in, and we can see. And again, it's not different. A lot of people think it's an aberration. It's far from an aberration. You look back at the presidencies of other people, and you can see it is not new at all.
You mentioned the myth of race. It may be a mythological construct, but not seeing race is not an option. I mean, and we know that
your question suggests that you're thinking of race as something real, as saying is not seeing race. And I'm not suggesting that we not see each other, but that we see each other as unique beings in the universe, not because we're racially different, but because we're unique anyway. None of us are the same. We're all unique. And that in itself gives a lie to this concept of race as a biological entity. No, there's no biological or scientific race, but there is race, the myth. And I agree, it's there. So when people say to me, I don't see race, they're basically saying, I don't see you, because I'm different. We're all different. You know what makes us unique in the universe? Ancestry. Not race, ancestry. We each have millions and millions of ancestors. Now, what happens in societies, if we take this myth of race and we divide ourselves up into racial enclaves, there's very little opportunity for people to have common ancestors because we work hard and we work mightily to make sure that there is no, quote, pollution of the race. Absent those barriers, our ancestors would look quite different and we would be a different kind of people. That's always a possibility. That's why when I was growing up, one of the greatest taboos in terms of things racial was any kind of close contact between a black male and a white female. That still is an amazing taboo throughout this country. But that's built on nothing less than fears and the belief in race as an entity. But if we were ever to allow ourselves to think beyond that, to see each other as, yes, we're unique, we're different, but it's only because of ancestry, not because of race.
For every person listening right now who understands this systemic racism in our culture and wants to make a difference, I know that you said educate yourself, keep learning, but what is one thing that you would have every person listening today do to affect positive change?
Well, I would say start treating every other person in the universe as your peer. Not looking up to anybody, not looking down to anybody, seeing everyone on eye-to-eye level and accepting the differences you see. See people. Don't be colorblind. Whatever. You know, I sometimes laugh when I hear that because my first response is, why would you voluntarily disable yourself and not see the color in front of you? No, see the person as they are, accept them as they are, as your peer. That's what I would say as a bottom line principle. That's where we start. We start by seeing each other as peers.
Terrence Roberts, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Terrence Roberts, he is one of the Little Rock Nine, one of the first 9 African-American students to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. He will be speaking on Friday, April 6th, 7 p.m. at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. The lecture is free and open to the public. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, Lindsay Moon, and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.